linen, and with his usual neat leg. The doctor was summoned in the usual way, and came to breakfast. So far as it was possible to comprehend him, without overstepping those delicate and gradual approaches which Mr. Lorry felt to be the only safe advance, he at first supposed that his daughter's marriage had taken place yesterday. An incidental allusion, purposely thrown out, to the day of the week and the day of the month, set him thinking and counting, and evidently made him uneasy. In all other respects, however, he was so composedly himself that Mr. Lorry determined to have the aid he sought. And that aid was his own. Therefore, when the breakfast was done and cleared away, and he and the doctor were left together, Mr. Lorry said feelingly, "My dear Manette, I'm anxious to have your opinion, in confidence, on a very curious case in which I am deeply interested. That is to say, it is very curious to me. Perhaps to your better information, it may be less so." Glancing at his hands, which were discoloured by his late work, the doctor looked troubled and listened attentively. He had already glanced at his hands more than once. "Dr. Manette," said Mr. Lorry, touching him affectionately on the arm, "the case is the case of a particularly dear friend of mine. Pray give your mind to it, and advise me well for his sake, and above all for his daughter's." "His daughter's, my dear Manette." "If I understand," said the doctor in a subdued tone, "some mental shock?"
"Yes."
"Be explicit," said the doctor. "Spare no detail." Mr. Lorry saw that they understood one another and proceeded. "My dear Manette, it is the case of an old and a prolonged shock, of great acuteness and severity to the affections, the feelings, the, as you express it, the mind. The mind. It is the case of a shock under which the sufferer was borne down, one cannot say for how long, because I believe he cannot calculate the time himself, and there are no other means of getting at it. It is the case of a shock from which the sufferer recovered, by a process that he cannot trace himself, as I once heard him publicly relate in a striking manner. It is the case of a shock from which he has recovered so completely as to be a highly intelligent man, capable of close application of mind and great exertion of body, and of constantly making fresh additions to his stock of knowledge, which was already very large. But unfortunately there has been," he paused, and took a deep breath, "a slight relapse." The doctor, in a low voice, asked, "Of how long duration?" 9 days and nights. "How did it show itself?" "I infer," glancing at his hands again, "in the resumption of some old pursuit connected with the shock." "That is the fact." "Now, did you ever see him?" asked the doctor, distinctly and collectedly, though in the same low voice. "Engaged in that pursuit originally?"
"Once."
"And when the relapse fell on him, was he in most respects, or in all respects, as he was then?"
"I think in all respects."
"You spoke of his daughter. Does his daughter know of the relapse?"
"No. It has been kept from her, and I hope will always be kept from her. It is known only to myself and to one other who may be trusted."
The doctor grasped his hand and murmured, "That was very kind. That was very thoughtful." Mr. Lorry grasped his hand in return, and neither of the two spoke for a little while.
"Now, my dear Manette," said Mr. Lorry at length, in his most considerate and most affectionate way,
"I am a mere man of business, and unfit to cope with such intricate and difficult matters. I do not possess the kind of information necessary. I do not possess the kind of intelligence. I want guiding. There is no man in this world on whom I could so rely for right guidance as on you. Tell me, how does this relapse come about? Is there danger of another? Could a repetition of it be prevented? How should a repetition of it be treated? How does it come about at all? What can I do for my friend? No man ever can have been more desirous in his heart to
to serve a friend than I am to serve mine, if I knew how. But I don't know how to originate in such a case. If your sagacity, knowledge, and experience could put me on the right track, I might be able to do so much. Unenlightened and undirected, I can do so little. Pray discuss it with me. Pray enable me to see it a little more clearly, and teach me how to be a little more useful." Dr. Manette sat meditating after these earnest words were spoken, and Mr. Lorry did not press him. "I think it probable," said the doctor, breaking silence with an effort, "that the relapse you have described, my dear friend, was not quite unforeseen by its subject."
"Was it dreaded by him?"
Mr. Lorry ventured to ask.
"Very much."
He said it with an involuntary shudder.
"You have no idea how such an apprehension weighs on the sufferer's mind, and how difficult, how almost impossible it is for him to force himself to utter a word upon the topic that oppresses him."
"Would he," asked Mr. Lorry, "be sensibly relieved if he could prevail upon himself to impart that secret brooding to anyone when it is on him?"
"I think so. But it is, as I have told you, next to impossible. I even believe it in some cases to be quite impossible."
"Now," said Mr. Lorry, gently laying his hand on the doctor's arm again, after a short silence on both sides, "to what would you refer this attack?"
"I believe," returned Dr. Manette, "that there had been a strong and extraordinary revival of the train of thought and remembrance that was the first cause of the malady. Some intense associations of a most distressing nature were vividly recalled, I think. It is probable that there had long been a dread lurking in his mind that those associations would be recalled, say, under certain circumstances, say, on a particular occasion. He tried to prepare himself in vain. Perhaps the effort to prepare himself made him less able to bear it."
"Would he remember what took place in the relapse?" asked Mr. Lorry with natural hesitation. The doctor looked desolately round the room, shook his head, and answered in a low voice,
"Not at all."
"Now, as to the future," hinted Mr. Lorry.
"As to the future," said the doctor, recovering firmness, "I should have great hope. As it pleased heaven in its mercy to restore him so soon, I should have great hope. He, yielding under the pressure of a complicated something long dreaded and long vaguely foreseen and contended against, and recovering after the cloud had burst and passed, I should hope that the worst was over."
"Well, well, that's good comfort. I am thankful," said Mr. Lorry.
"I am thankful,"
repeated the doctor, bending his head with reverence.
"There are two other points," said Mr. Lorry, "on which I am anxious to be instructed. I may go on?" "You cannot do your friend a better service."
The doctor gave him his hand.
"To the first, then. He is of a studious habit and unusually energetic. He applies himself with great ardour to the acquisition of professional knowledge, to the conducting of experiments, to many things. Now, does he do too much?"
"I think not.
It may be the character of his mind to be always in singular need of occupation. That may be, in part, natural to it. In part, the result of affliction. The less it was occupied with healthy things, the more it would be in danger of turning in the unhealthy direction. He may have observed himself and made the discovery."
"You are sure that he is not under too great a strain?"
"I think I am quite sure of it."
"My dear Manette, if he were overworked..." "Not my dear Lorry, I doubt if that could easily be. There has been a violent stress in one direction, and it needs a counterweight. Excuse me, as a persistent man of business, assuming for a moment that he was overworked, it would show itself in some renewal of this disorder?"
"I do not think so."
I do not think, said Dr. Manette with the firmness of self-conviction, that anything but the one train of association would renew it. I think that henceforth nothing but some extraordinary jarring of that chord could renew it. After what has happened, and after his recovery, I find it difficult to imagine any such violent sounding of that string again. I trust, and I almost believe, that the circumstances likely to renew it are exhausted.
He spoke with the diffidence of a man who knew how slight a thing would overset the delicate organization of the mind, and yet with the confidence of a man who had slowly won his assurance out of personal endurance and distress. It was not for his friend to abate that confidence. He professed himself more relieved and encouraged than he really was, and approached his second and last point. He felt it to be the most difficult of all, but remembering his old Sunday morning conversation with Miss Pross, and remembering what he had seen in the last 9 days, he knew that he must face it. The occupation resumed under the influence of this passing affliction, so happily recovered from, said Mr. Lorry, clearing his throat, we will call, blacksmith's work. Blacksmith's work. We will say, to put a case, and for the sake of illustration, that he had been used, in his bad time, to work at a little forge. We will say that he was unexpectedly found at his forge again. Is it not a pity that he should keep it by him? The doctor shaded his forehead with his hand and beat his foot nervously on the ground. He has always kept it by him, said Mr. Lorry, with an anxious look at his friend. Now, would it not be better that he should let it go? Still the doctor, with shaded forehead, beat his foot nervously on the ground. You do not find it easy to advise me, said Mr. Lorry. I quite understand it to be a nice question. And yet I think... And there he shook his head and stopped. You see, said Dr. Manette, turning to him after an uneasy pause, it is very hard to explain consistently the innermost workings of this poor man's mind. He once yearned so frightfully for that occupation, and it was so welcome when it came. No doubt it relieved his pain so much by substituting the perplexity of the fingers for the perplexity of the brain, and by substituting, as he became more practiced, the ingenuity of the hands for the ingenuity of the mental torture, that he has never been able to bear the thought of putting it quite out of his reach. Even now, when I believe he is more hopeful of himself than he has ever been, and even speaks of himself with a kind of confidence, the idea that he might need that old employment and not find it gives him a sudden sense of terror, like that which one may fancy strikes to the heart of a lost child. He looked like his illustration as he raised his eyes to Mr. Lorry's face, but may not mind, I ask for information, as a plodding man of business who only deals with such material objects as guineas, shillings, and banknotes, may not the retention of the thing involve the retention of the idea? If the thing were gone, my dear Manette, might not the fear go with it? In short, is it not a concession to the misgiving to keep the forge?
There was another silence. You see, too, said the doctor tremulously, it is such an old companion.
I would not keep it, said Mr. Lorry, shaking his head, for he gained in firmness as he saw the doctor disquieted. I would recommend him to sacrifice it. I only want your authority. I'm sure it does no good. Come, give me your authority. Like a dear good man. For his daughter's sake, my dear Manette. Very strange to see what a struggle there was within him.
In her name, then, let it be done. I sanction it.
But I would not take it away while he was present. Let it be removed when he is not there. Let him miss his old companion after an absence. Mr. Lorry readily engaged for that, and the conference was ended. They passed the day in the country, and the doctor was quite restored. On the three following days he remained perfectly well, and on the 14th day he went away to join Lucy and her husband. The precaution that had been taken to account for his silence Mr. Lorry had previously explained to him, and he had written to Lucy in accordance with it, and she had no suspicions. On the night of the day on which he left the house, Mr. Lorry went into his room with a chopper, saw, chisel and hammer, attended by Miss Pross carrying a light. There, with closed doors and in a mysterious and guilty manner, Mr. Lorry hacked the shoemaker's bench to pieces, while Miss Pross held the candle as if she were assisting at a murder, for which, indeed, in her grimness, she was no unsuitable figure. The burning of the body, previously reduced to pieces convenient for the purpose, was commenced without delay in the kitchen fire, and the tools, shoes, and leather were buried in the garden. So wicked the destruction and secrecy appear to honest minds, that Mr. Lorry and Miss Pross, while engaged in the commission of their deed and in the removal of its traces, almost felt and almost looked like accomplices in a horrible crime. Chapter 20. A Plea. When the newly married pair came home, the first person who appeared to offer his congratulations was Sidney Carton. They had not been at home many hours when he presented himself. He was not improved in habits, or in looks, or in manner, but there was a certain rugged air of fidelity about him, which was new to the observation of Charles Darnay. He watched his opportunity of taking Darnay aside into a window, and of speaking to him when no one overheard. "Mr. Darnay," said Carton, "I wish we might be friends." "We are already friends, I hope." "You are good enough to say so, as a fashion of speech, but I don't mean any fashion of speech. Indeed, when I say I wish we might be friends, I scarcely mean quite that, either." Charles Darnay, as was natural, asked him in all good humour and good fellowship, what did he mean? "Upon my life," said Carton, smiling, "I find that easier to comprehend in my own mind than to convey to yours. However, let me try. You remember a certain famous occasion when I was more drunk than usual? I remember a certain famous occasion when you forced me to confess that you had been drinking. I remember it too. The curse of those occasions is heavy upon me, for I always remember them. I hope it may be taken into account one day when all days are at an end for me. Don't be alarmed. I'm not going to preach. I'm not at all alarmed. Earnestness in you is anything but alarming to me." "Ah," said Carton, with a careless wave of his hand, as if he waved that away. "On the drunken occasion in question, one of a large number, as you know, I was insufferable about liking you and not liking you. I wish you would forget it." "I forgot it long ago." "Fashion of speech again. But, Mr. Darnay, oblivion is not so easy to me as you represent it to be to you. I have by no means forgotten it, and a light answer does not help me to forget it." "If it was a light answer," returned Darnay, "I beg your forgiveness for it. I had no other object than to turn a slight thing, which to my surprise seems to trouble you too much, aside. I declare to you, on the faith of a gentleman, that I have long dismissed it from my mind. Good heaven, what was there to dismiss? Have I had nothing more important to remember in the great service you rendered me that day?" "As to the great service," said Carton, "I am bound to avow to you, when you speak of it in that way, that it was mere professional claptrap. I don't know that I cared what became of you when I rendered it. Mind, I say when I rendered it. I'm speaking of the past." "You make light of the obligation," returned Darnay, "but I will not quarrel with your light answer. Genuine truth, Mr. Darnay, trust me. I've gone aside from my purpose. I was speaking about our being friends. Now, you know me. You know I am incapable of all the higher and better flights of men. If you doubt it, ask Stryver, and he'll tell you so. I prefer to form my own opinion without the aid of his. Well, at any rate, you know me as a dissolute dog who has never done any good and never will." "I don't know that you never will." "But I do, and you must take my word for it. Well, if you could endure to have such a worthless fellow, and a fellow of such indifferent reputation, coming and going at odd times, I should ask that I might be permitted to come and go as a privileged person here. That I might be regarded as an useless, and I would add, if it were not for the resemblance I detected between you and me, an unornamental piece of furniture, tolerated for its old service and taken no notice of. I doubt if I should abuse the permission. It is 100 to 1 if I should avail myself of it 4 times a year. It would satisfy me, I dare say, to know that I had it. Will you try? That is another way of saying that I am placed on the footing I have indicated. I thank you, Darnay. I may use that freedom with your name. I think so, Carton, by this time. They shook hands upon it, and Sidney turned away. Within a minute afterwards he was, to all outward appearance, as unsubstantial as ever. When he was gone, and in the course of an evening passed with Miss Pross, the doctor, and Mr. Lorry, Charles Darnay made some mention of this conversation in general terms, and spoke of Sidney Carton as a problem of carelessness and recklessness. He spoke of him, in short, not bitterly, or meaning to bear hard upon him, but as anybody might who saw him as he showed himself. He had no idea that this could dwell in the thoughts of his fair young wife, but when he afterwards joined her in their own rooms, he found her waiting for him with the old pretty lifting of the forehead, strongly marked. "We are thoughtful tonight," said Darnay, drawing his arm about her. "Yes, dearest Charles," with her hands on his breast, and the inquiring and attentive expression fixed upon him. "We are rather thoughtful tonight, for we have something on our mind tonight. What is it, my Lucy? Will you promise not to press one question on me, if I beg you not to ask it?" "Will I promise? What will I not promise to my love?" What indeed, with his hand putting aside the golden hair from the cheek, and his other hand against the heart that beat for him.
"I think, Charles, poor Mr. Carton deserves more consideration and respect than you expressed for him tonight."
"Indeed, my own? Why so?"
"That is what you are not to ask me. But I think, I know, he does."
"If you know it, it is enough. What would you have me do, my life?"
"I would ask you, dearest, to be very generous with him, always, and very lenient on his faults when he is not by. I would ask you to believe that he has a heart he very, very seldom reveals, and that there are deep wounds in it. My dear, I have seen it bleeding."
"It is a painful reflection to me," said Charles Darnay, quite astounded, "that I should have done him any wrong. I never thought this of him."
"My husband, it is so. I fear he is not to be reclaimed. There is scarcely a hope that anything in his character or fortunes is irreparable now. But I am sure that he is capable of good things, gentle things, even magnanimous things."
She looked so beautiful in the purity of her faith in this lost man, that her husband could have looked at her as she was for hours.
"And, oh, my dearest love," she urged,
clinging nearer to him, laying her head upon his breast, and raising her eyes to his,
"remember how strong we are in our happiness, and how weak he is in his misery."
The supplication touched him home. "I will always remember it, dear heart. I will remember it as long as I live." He bent over the golden head, and put the rosy lips to his, and folded her in his arms. If one forlorn wanderer, then pacing the dark streets, could have heard her innocent disclosure, and could have seen the drops of pity kissed away by her husband from the soft blue eyes so loving of that husband, he might have cried to the night, and the words would not have parted from his lips for the first time. "God bless her for her sweet compassion." Chapter 21. Echoing Footsteps. A wonderful corner for echoes, it has been remarked, that corner where the doctor lived. Ever busily winding the golden thread which bound her husband and her father and herself and her old directress and companion in a life of quiet bliss, Lucy sat in the still house in the tranquilly resounding corner, listening to the echoing footsteps of years. At first there were times, though she was a perfectly happy young wife, when her work would slowly fall from her hands and her eyes would be dimmed. For there was something coming in the echoes, something light, afar off, and scarcely audible yet, that stirred her heart too much. Fluttering hopes and doubts, hopes of a love as yet unknown to her, doubts of her remaining upon earth to enjoy that new delight, divided her breast. Among the echoes, then, there would arise the sound of footsteps at her own early grave, and thoughts of the husband who would be left so desolate, and who would mourn for her so much, swelled to her eyes, and broke like waves. That time passed, and her little Lucy lay on her bosom. Then, among the advancing echoes, there was the tread of her tiny feet and the sound of her prattling words. Let greater echoes resound as they would, the young mother at the cradle side could always hear those coming. They came, and the shady house was sunny with a child's laugh, and the divine friend of children, to whom in her trouble she had confided hers, seemed to take her child in his arms, as he took the child of old, and made it a sacred joy to her. Ever busily winding the golden thread that bound them all together, weaving the service of her happy influence through the tissue of all their lives, and making it predominate nowhere, Lucy heard in the echoes of years none but friendly and soothing sounds. Her husband's step was strong and prosperous among them, her father's firm and equal. Lo, Miss Pross, in harness of string, awakening the echoes as an unruly charger, whip-corrected, snorting and pawing the earth under the plane tree in the garden. Even when there were sounds of sorrow among the rest, they were not harsh nor cruel. Even when golden hair, like her own, lay in a halo on a pillow round the worn face of a little boy, and he said with a radiant smile, "Dear Papa and Mamma, I am very sorry to leave you both, and to leave my pretty sister, but I am called, and I must go." Those were not tears all of agony that wetted his young mother's cheek, as the spirit departed from her embrace that had been entrusted to it. Suffer them and forbid them not. They see my father's face. O Father, blessed words! Thus the rustling of an angel's wings got blended with the other echoes, and they were not wholly of earth, but had in them that breath of heaven. Sighs of the winds that blew over a little garden tomb were mingled with them also, and both were audible to Lucy in a hushed murmur, like the breathing of a summer sea asleep upon a sandy shore, as the little Lucy, comically studious at the task of the morning, or dressing a doll at her mother's footstool, chattered in the tongues of the two cities that were blended in her life. The echoes rarely answered to the actual tread of Sidney Carton. Some half-dozen times a year, at most, he claimed his privilege of coming in uninvited, and would sit among them through the evening, as he had once done, often. He never came there heated with wine. And one other thing regarding him was whispered in the echoes, which had been whispered by all true echoes for ages and ages. No man ever really loved a woman, lost her, and knew her with a blameless, though an unchanged, mind, when she was a wife and a mother. But her children had a strange sympathy with him, an instinctive delicacy of pity for him. What fine hidden sensibilities are touched in such a case, no echoes tell. But it is so, and it was so here. Carton was the first stranger to whom little Lucy held out her chubby arms, and he kept his place with her as she grew. The little boy had spoken of him almost at the last. "Poor Carton, kiss him for me." Mr. Stryver shouldered his way through the law like some great engine forcing itself through turbid water, and dragged his useful friend in his wake like a boat towed astern. As the boat so favoured is usually in a rough plight, and mostly under water, so Sidney had a swamped life of it. But easy and strong custom, unhappily so much easier and stronger in him than any stimulating sense of desert or disgrace, made it the life he was to lead. And he no more thought of emerging from his state of lion's jackal than any real jackal may be supposed to think of rising to be a lion. Stryver was rich, had married a florid widow with property and three boys, who had nothing particularly shining about them but the straight hair of their dumpling heads. These three young gentlemen, Mr. Stryver, exuding patronage of a most offensive quality from every pore, had walked before him like three sheep to the quiet corner in Soho, and had offered as pupils to Lucy's husband, delicately saying, "Hallo! Here are three lumps of bread and cheese towards your matrimonial picnic, darnay." The polite rejection of the three lumps of bread and cheese had quite bloated Mr. Stryver with indignation, which he afterwards turned to account in the training of the young gentlemen by directing them to beware of the pride of beggars, like that tutor fellow. He was also in the habit of declaiming to Mrs. Stryver, over his full-bodied wine, on the arts Mrs. Darnay had once put in practice to catch him, and on the diamond-cut diamond arts in himself, madam, which had rendered him not to be caught. Some of his King's Bench familiars, who were occasionally parties to the full-bodied wine and the lie, excused him for the latter by saying that he had told it so often that he believed it himself, which is surely such an incorrigible aggravation of an originally bad offence as to justify any such offenders being carried off to some suitably retired spot and there hanged out of the way. These were among the echoes to which Lucy, sometimes pensive, sometimes amused and laughing, listened in the echoing corner until her little daughter was 6 years old. How near to her heart the echoes of her child's tread came, and those of her own dear father's, always active and self-possessed, and those of her dear husband's, need not be told. Nor how the lightest echo of their united home, directed by herself with such a wise and elegant thrift that it was more abundant than any waste, was music to her. Nor how there were echoes all about her, sweet in her ears, of the many times her father had told her that he found her more devoted to him, married, if that could be, than single, and of the many times her husband had said to her that no cares and duties seemed to divide her love from him or her help to him, and asked her, "What is the magic secret, my darling, of your being everything to all of us, as if there were only one of us, yet never seeming to be hurried or to have too much to do?" But there were other echoes from a distance that rumbled menacingly in the corner all through this space of time. And it was now, about little Lucy's sixth birthday, that they began to have an awful sound, as of a great storm in France, with a dreadful sea rising. On a night in mid-July, 1789, Mr. Lorry came in late from Tellson's and sat himself down by Lucy and her husband in the dark window. It was a hot, wild night, and they were all three reminded of the old Sunday night when they had looked at the lightning from the same place. "I began to think," said Mr. Lorry, pushing his brown wig back, "that I should have to pass the night at Tellson's. We've been so full of business all day that we've not known what to do first or which way to turn. There's such an uneasiness in Paris that we have actually a run of confidence upon us. Our customers over there seem not to be able to confide their property to us fast enough. There is positively a mania among some of them for sending it to England." "That has a bad look," said Darnay. "A bad look, you say, my dear Darnay. Yes, but we don't know what reason there is in it. People are so unreasonable. Some of us at Tellson's are getting old, and we really can't be troubled out of the ordinary course without due occasion." "Still," said Darnay, "you know how gloomy and threatening the sky is." "I know that, to be sure. assented Mr. Lorry, trying to persuade himself that his sweet temper was soured and that he grumbled. "But I am determined to be peevish after my long day's botheration. Where is Manette?" "Here he is," said the doctor, entering the dark room at the moment. "I'm quite glad you're at home. These hurries and forebodings by which I've been surrounded all day long have made me nervous without reason. You're not going out, I hope?"
"No, I'm going to play backgammon with you, if you like," said the doctor.
"I don't think I do like, if I may speak my mind. I'm not fit to be pitted against you tonight. Is the tea board still there, Lucy? I can't see."
"Of course, it has been kept for you."
"Thank you, my dear. The precious child is safe in bed and sleeping soundly." "That's right. All safe and well. I don't know why anything should be otherwise than safe and well here, thank God. But I've been so put out all day, and I'm not as young as I was. My tea, my dear. Thank you. Now come and take your place in the circle, and let us sit quiet and hear the echoes about which you have your theory. Oh, not a theory. It was a fancy." "A fancy, then, my wise pet," said Mr. Lorry, patting her hand. "They are very numerous and very loud, though, are they not? Only hear them. Headlong, mad, and dangerous footsteps to force their way into anybody's life. Footsteps not easily made clean again, if once stained red. The footsteps raging in Saint-Antoine, far off, as the little circle sat in the dark London window." Saint-Antoine had been, that morning, a vast, dusky mass of scarecrows heaving to and fro, with frequent gleams of light above the billowy heads, where steel blades and bayonets shone in the sun. A tremendous roar arose from the throat of Saint-Antoine, and a forest of naked arms struggled in the air like shriveled branches of trees in a winter wind, all the fingers convulsively clutching at every weapon or semblance of a weapon that was thrown up from the depths below, no matter how far off. Who gave them out? Whence they last came? Where they began? Through what agency they crookedly quivered and jerked scores at a time over the heads of the crowd like a kind of lightning? No eye in the throng could have told. But muskets were being distributed. So were cartridges, powder and ball, bars of iron and wood, knives, axes, pikes, every weapon that distracted ingenuity could discover or devise. People who could lay hold of nothing else set themselves with bleeding hands to force stones and bricks out of their places in walls. Every pulse and heart in Saint-Antoine was on high fever strain and at high fever heat. Every living creature there held life as of no account and was demented with a passionate readiness to sacrifice it. As a whirlpool of boiling waters has a centre point, so all this raging circled round Defarge's wine shop, and every human drop in the cauldron had a tendency to be sucked towards the vortex where Defarge himself, already begrimed with gunpowder and sweat, issued orders, issued arms, thrust this man back, dragged this man forward, disarmed one to arm another, laboured and strove in the thickest of the uproar. "Keep near to me, Jack Three," cried Defarge, "and do you, Jacques One and Two, separate and put yourselves at the head of as many of these patriots as you can. Where is my wife?" "Eh, well, here you see me," said Madame, composed as ever, but not knitting today. Madame's resolute right hand was occupied with an axe, in place of the usual softer implements, and in her girdle were a pistol and a cruel knife. "Where do you go, my wife?" "I go," said Madame, "with you at present. You shall see me at the head of women by and by." "Come then," cried Defarge in a resounding voice. "Patriots and friends, we are ready. The Bastille!" With a roar that sounded as if all the breath in France had been shaped into the detested word, the living sea rose wave on wave, depth on depth, and overflowed the city to that point. Alarm bells ringing, drums beating, the sea raging and thundering on its new beach, the attack began. Deep ditches, double drawbridge, massive stone walls, eight great towers, cannon, muskets, fire and smoke. through the fire and through the smoke, in the fire and in the smoke, for the sea cast him up against a cannon, and on the instant he became a cannoneer. Defarge of the wine shop worked like a manful soldier. 2 fierce hours. Deep ditch, single drawbridge, massive stone walls, 8 great towers, cannon, muskets, fire and smoke. 1 drawbridge down. Work, comrades, all work. Work, Jacques 1, Jacques 2, Jacques 1,000, Jacques 2,000, Jacques 5 and 20,000, in the name of all the angels or the devils, which you prefer. Work! Thus Defarge of the wine shop, still at his gun, which had long grown hot. To me, women, cried Madame, his wife. What? We can kill as well as the men when the place is taken. And to her, with a shrill, thirsty cry, trooping women, variously armed, but all armed alike in hunger and revenge. Cannon, muskets, fire and smoke. But still the deep ditch, the single drawbridge, the massive stone walls and the 8 great towers. Slight displacements of the raging sea, made by the falling wounded. Flashing weapons, blazing torches, smoking wagon loads of wet straw, hard work at neighbouring barricades in all directions. Shrieks, volleys, execrations, bravery without stint, boom, smash and rattle, and the furious sounding of the living sea, but still the deep ditch, and the single drawbridge, and the massive stone walls, and the 8 great towers, and still Defarge of the wine shop at his gun, grown doubly hot by the service of 4 fierce hours. A white flag from within the fortress, and a parley, this dimly perceptible through the raging storm. Nothing audible in it. Suddenly the sea rose immeasurably wider and higher, and swept Defarge of the wine shop over the lowered drawbridge, past the massive stone outer walls, in among the 8 great towers surrendered. So resistless was the force of the ocean bearing him on, that even to draw his breath or turn his head was as impracticable as if he had been struggling in the surf at the South Sea, until he was landed in the outer courtyard of the Bastille. There, against an angle of a wall, he made a struggle to look about him. Jacques 3 was nearly at his side. Madame Defarge, still heading some of her women, was visible in the inner distance, and her knife was in her hand. Everywhere was tumult, exultation, deafening and maniacal bewilderment, astounding noise, yet furious dumb show. The prisoners! The records! The secret cells! The instruments of torture! The prisoners! Of all these cries and 10,000 incoherences, the prisoners! Was the cry most taken up by the sea that rushed in, as if there were an eternity of people, as well as of time and space. When the foremost billows rolled past, bearing the prison officers with them, and threatening them all with instant death if any secret nook remained undisclosed, Defarge laid his strong hand on the breast of one of these men, a man with a grey head who had had a lighted torch in his hand, separated him from the rest, and got him between himself and the wall. "Show me the North Tower," said Defarge. "Quick!"
"I will, faithfully," replied the man, "if you will come with me. But there is no one there."
"What is the meaning of 105 North Tower?" asked Defarge. "Quick!"
"The meaning, monsieur? Does it mean a captive or a place of captivity?
Or do you mean that I shall strike you dead?"
"Kill him!"
croaked Jacques Three, who had come close up.
"Monsieur, it is a cell."
"Show it me."
"Pass this way, then."
Jacques Three, with his usual craving on him, and evidently disappointed by the dialogue taking a turn that did not seem to promise bloodshed, held by Defarge's arm, as he held by the turnkeys. Their 3 heads had been close together during this brief discourse, and it had been as much as they could do to hear one another, even then. So tremendous was the noise of the living ocean in its eruption into the fortress, and its inundation of the courts and passages and staircases. All around outside, too, it beat the walls with a deep, hoarse roar, from which, occasionally, some partial shouts of tumult broke and leapt into the air like spray. Through gloomy vaults where the light of day had never shone, past hideous doors of dark dens and cages, down cavernous flights of steps, and again up steep, rugged ascents of stone and brick, more like dry waterfalls than staircases, Defarge, the turnkey, and Jacques Three, linked hand and arm, went with all the speed they could make. Here and there, especially at first, the inundation started on them and swept by. But when they had done descending and were winding and climbing up a tower, they were alone. Hemmed in here by the massive thickness of walls and arches, the storm within the fortress and without was only audible to them in a dull, subdued way, as if the noise out of which they had come had almost destroyed their sense of hearing. The turnkey stopped at a low door, put a key in a clashing lock, swung the door slowly open, and said, as they all bent their heads and passed in,
105, North Tower.
There was a small, heavily grated, unglazed window high in the wall, with a stone screen before it, so that the sky could be only seen by stooping low and looking up. There was a small chimney, heavily barred across, a few feet within. There was a heap of old feathery wood ashes on the hearth. There was a stool and table and a straw bed. There were the four blackened walls and a rusted iron ring in one of them.
"Pass that torch slowly along these walls, that I may see them," said Defarge to the turnkey.
The man obeyed, and Defarge followed the light closely with his eyes.
"Stop! Look there, Jacques."
"A.M.,"
croaked Jacques Three as he read greedily.
"Alexandra Manette," said Defarge in his ear, following the letters with his swart forefinger, deeply ingrained with gunpowder. And here he wrote, "A poor physician." And it was he, without doubt, who scratched a calendar on the stone.
"What is that in your hand?"
"A crowbar? Give it me."
He had still the linstock of his gun in his own hand. He made a sudden exchange of the two instruments, and turning on the worm-eaten stool and table, beat them to pieces in a few blows.
"Hold the light higher," he said wrathfully to the turnkey. "Look among those fragments with care, Jacques, and see. Here is my knife," throwing it to him. "Rip open that bed and search the straw. Hold the light higher, you!"
With a menacing look at the turnkey, he crawled upon the hearth, and peering up the chimney, struck and prized at its sides with the crowbar, and worked at the iron grating across it. In a few minutes, some mortar and dust came dropping down, which he averted his face to avoid. And in it, and in the old wood ashes, and in a crevice in the chimney into which his weapon had slipped or wrought itself, he groped with a cautious touch.
"Nothing in the wood, nothing in the straw, Jacques?"
"Nothing."
"Let us collect them together in the middle of the cell. So, light them, you."
The turnkey fired the little pile, which blazed high and hot. Stooping again to come out at the low arched door, they left it burning, and retraced their way to the courtyard, seeming to recover their sense of hearing as they came down, until they were in the raging flood once more. They found it surging and tossing in quest of Defarge himself. Saint-Antoine was clamorous to have its wine-shop keeper foremost in the guard upon the governor who had defended the Bastille and shot the people. Otherwise the governor would not be marched to the Hôtel de Ville for judgment. Otherwise the governor would escape, and the people's blood, suddenly of some value, after many years of worthlessness, be unavenged. In the howling universe of passion and contention that seemed to encompass this grim old officer, conspicuous in his grey coat and red decoration, there was but one quite steady figure, and that was a woman's.
"See, there is my husband," she cried, pointing him out. "See, Defarge."
She stood immovable close to the grim old officer, and remained immovable close to him. Remained immovable close to him through the streets, as Defarge and the rest bore him along. Remained immovable close to him when he was got near his destination and began to be struck at from behind. Remained immovable close to him when the long gathering rain of stabs and blows fell heavy. Was so close to him when he dropped dead under it, that suddenly animated, she put her foot upon his neck, and with her cruel knife, long ready, hewed off his head. The hour was come when Saint-Antoine was to execute his horrible idea of hoisting up men for lamps to show what he could be and do. Saint Antoine's blood was up, and the blood of tyranny and domination by the Iron Hand was down. Down on the steps of the Hôtel de Ville where the governor's body lay. Down on the sole of the shoe of Madame Defarge, where she had trodden on the body to steady it for mutilation. "Lower the lamp yonder!" cried Saint Antoine, after glaring round for a new means of death. "Here is one of his soldiers to be left on guard." The swinging sentinel was posted, and the sea rushed on. The sea of black and threatening waters, and of destructive upheaving, of wave against wave, whose depths were yet unfathomed, and whose forces were yet unknown. The remorseless sea of turbulently swaying shapes, voices of vengeance, and faces hardened in the furnaces of suffering until the touch of pity could make no mark on them. But in the ocean of faces, where every fierce and furious expression was in vivid life, there were two groups of faces, each seven in number, so fixedly contrasting with the rest, that never did sea roll which bore more memorable wrecks with it. Seven faces of prisoners, suddenly released by the storm that had burst their tomb, were carried high overhead, all scared, all lost, all wondering and amazed, as if the last day were come, and those who rejoiced around them were lost spirits. Other seven faces there were, carried higher, seven dead faces, whose drooping eyelids and half-seen eyes awaited the last day. Impassive faces, yet with a suspended, not an abolished, expression on them. Faces, rather, in a fearful pause, as having yet to raise the dropped lids of the eyes, and bear witness with the bloodless lips, "Thou didst it." Seven prisoners released, seven gory heads on pikes, the keys of the accursed fortress, of the eight strong towers, some discovered letters and other memorials of prisoners of old time, long dead of broken hearts, such and such like, the loudly echoing footsteps of Saint Antoine, escort through the Paris streets in mid-July 1789. Now heaven defeat the fancy of Lucy Darnay, and keep these feet far out of her life. For they are headlong, mad, and dangerous, and in the years so long after the breaking of the cask at Defarge's wine-shop door, they are not easily purified when once stained red. Chapter 22. The Sea Still Rises. Haggard Saint Antoine had had only one exultant week in which to soften his modicum of hard and bitter bread to such extent as he could, with the relish of fraternal embraces and congratulations, when Madame Defarge sat at her counter, as usual, presiding over the customers. Madame Defarge wore no rose in her head, for the great brotherhood of spies had become, even in one short week, extremely chary of trusting themselves to the saints' mercies. The lamps across his streets had a portentously elastic swing with them. Madame Defarge, with her arms folded, sat in the morning light and heat, contemplating the wine-shop and the street. In both there were several knots of loungers, squalid and miserable, but now with a manifest sense of power enthroned on their distress. The raggedest nightcap awry on the wretchedest head had this crooked significance in it. I know how hard it has grown for me, the wearer of this, to support life in myself. But do you know how easy it has grown for me, the wearer of this, to destroy life in you? Every lean, bare arm that had been without work before had this work always ready for it now that it could strike. The fingers of the knitting women were vicious, with the experience that they could tear. There was a change in the appearance of Saint Antoine. The image had been hammering into this for hundreds of years, and the last finishing blows had told mightily on the expression. Madame Defarge sat observing it with such suppressed approval as was to be desired in the leader of the Saint-Antoine women. One of her sisterhood knitted beside her. The short, rather plump wife of a starved grocer, and the mother of two children withal, this lieutenant had already earned the complimentary name of The Vengeance.
"Hark!" said The Vengeance. "Listen, then. Who comes?"
As if a train of powder laid from the outermost bound of Saint-Antoine Quarter to the wine-shop door had been suddenly fired, a fast-spreading murmur came rushing along. "It is Defarge," said Madame. "Silence, patriots!" Defarge came in breathless, pulled off a red cap he wore, and looked around him.
"Listen, everywhere," said Madame again. "Listen to him!"
Defarge stood, panting against a background of eager eyes and open mouths, formed outside the door. All those within the wine-shop had sprung to their feet.
"Say then, my husband, what is it?"
"News from the other world."
"How then?" cried Madame contemptuously. "The other world!
Does everybody here recall old Foulon, who told the famished people that they might eat grass, and who died and went to hell?"
"Everybody!" from all throats.
"The news is of him. He is among us."
"Among us?"
from the universal throat again.
"And dead?"
"Not dead.
He feared us so much, and with reason, that he caused himself to be represented as dead, and had a grand mock funeral. But they have found him alive, hiding in the country, and have brought him in. I have seen him but now, on his way to the Hôtel de Ville, a prisoner. I have said that he had reason to fear us. Say all! Had he reason?"
Wretched old sinner of more than 80 years, if he had never known it yet, he would have known it in his heart of hearts, if he could have heard the answering cry. A moment of profound silence followed. Defarge and his wife looked steadfastly at one another. The Vengeance stooped, and the jar of a drum was heard as she moved it at her feet behind the counter.
"Patriots!" said Defarge in a determined voice. "Are we ready?"
Instantly, Madame Defarge's knife was in her girdle. The drum was beating in the streets as if it and a drummer had flown together by magic. And the Vengeance, uttering terrific shrieks and flinging her arms about her head, like all the 40 furies at once, was tearing from house to house, rousing the women. The men were terrible in the bloody-minded anger with which they looked from windows, caught up what arms they had, and came pouring down into the streets. But the women were a sight to chill the boldest. From such household occupations as their bare poverty yielded, from their children, from their aged and their sick, crouching on the bare ground, famished and naked, they ran out with streaming hair, urging one another and themselves to madness, with the wildest cries and actions.
"Villain Foulon, taken my sister! Old Foulon, taken my mother! Miscreant Foulon, taken my daughter!"
Then a score of others ran into the midst of these, beating their breasts, tearing their hair, and screaming,
"Foulon alive!
Foulon, who told the starving people they might eat grass! Foulon, who told my old father that he might eat grass when I had no bread to give him! Foulon, who told my baby it might suck grass when these breasts were dry with want! Oh, Mother of God, this Foulon! Oh, heaven, our suffering! Hear me, my dead baby and my withered father! I swear on my knees on these stones to avenge you, our Foulon! Husbands and brothers and young men, give us the blood of Foulon. Give us the head of Foulon. Give us the heart of Foulon. Give us the body and soul of Foulon. Rend Foulon to pieces and dig him into the ground that grass may grow from him."
With these cries, numbers of the women lashed into blind frenzy, whirled about, striking and tearing at their own friends until they dropped into a passionate swoon and were only saved by the men belonging to them from being trampled underfoot. Nevertheless, not a moment was lost. Not a moment. This Foulon was of the Hôtel de Ville and might be loosed. Never if Saint-Antoine knew his own sufferings, insults and wrongs. Armed men and women flocked out of the quarter so fast and drew even these little dregs after them with such a force of suction that within a quarter of an hour there was not a human creature in Saint-Antoine's bosom but a few old crones and the wailing children.
No, they were all by that time choking the hall of examination, where this old man, ugly and wicked, was, and overflowing into the adjacent open space and street. The Defarges, husband and wife, the Vengeance, and Jacques Three were in the first press, and at no great distance from him in the hall. "See!" cried Madame, pointing with her knife. "See the old villain bound with ropes! That